Welcome to Greek Club at Concordia Seminary. We are beginning the fall, the winter term of the 2010-2011 academic year. This means that I'm getting old because I joined the faculty in 1992, which was before. Now you guys were all born then, for crying out loud. But we're in 2 Corinthians and we're in chapter 5. And we're back from the break. And I believe, I couldn't quite remember, but I believe we're going to pick up at verse 6. And if not, if that's not where we're supposed to, that's where we're going to do it anyway. I have a good suggestive translation for one particular verb. I'm very proud of myself. I know it's probably sinful, but that's what we're going to do. So the paragraph ends, in 1 to 5, Paul has been talking about groaning in this earthly fallen body and world and wanting not to be naked and knowing that we will put on, at the resurrection, put on a body from heaven, that is, it comes from God. And then at the end of verse 4, in order that that which is mortal, the mortal thing, might be swallowed up by life, which again has to be a reference to the resurrection of the body, given the parallels to 1 Corinthians. And then he says in verse 5, and the one who prepares us unto this very thing is God, the one who gave to us the down payment of the Spirit. And that's actually a very important statement because the Spirit is the eschatological link, if I could say it that way, between the beginning of the latter days and the consummation of the latter days, right? So we pick up then in verse 6, and I'm going to suggest, I don't quite know what else to do with this, we don't have a real verb until we get to verse 8. We have two participles and a parenthetical expression. So what I'm going to suggest is that Paul, it's almost maybe a form of what the grammars who have to have a name for everything, as you know, might call anakaluthen, where Paul starts one way and then picks up another way. So we'll start with a form of thareo, which means to be of good courage or to be courageous. And it's a participle, but if you'll just glance at verse 8, you'll see that, oh, there it is again, tharumen. So I think what Paul does is he starts the thought one way, makes a parenthetical comment, and then begins again, or something like that. So at any rate, it would sound something like this, at least if the Greek speaker were living in the Midwest in the 21st century. Tharuntes un pantata kai edates hati en demuntes en tosomati, ek de mumen apa tu kiriu, dia pistos gar peri patumen u dia edus, dot, dot, dot. So again, this is a sentence fragment. So participle, therefore, maybe, I'm not sure what force to give these participles because it is, again, kind of a, almost seems like a sentence fragment. Let's do causal. Therefore, because we are of good courage, always, and because we know, eidotes is from oida, and we know that, en de muntes, this is from en de meo, which means to be at home in something, somewhere, while we are at home in the body, now the first person plural verb, the we, which is the referent of the participles in predicate position, while we are at home in the body, ek de mumen, we are ekdemeoing, we are away from the Lord. Now let's explain that. We know this, verse 7, for through faith, emphatic, we are walking or living, not through eidos. This is a third declension noun. It means form or appearance, or it's normally translated here, sight. But you could actually translate it appearance. And that would sort of get the job done, I think. But this is the famous quote, you know, that we use all the time, and rightly so, of walking by faith and not by sight. So what will be has not yet appeared. This, of course, is the not yet of Christian experience. And again, all those participles sort of have to have as their antecedent. You need a main verb. You need an indicative or imperative that's not in a dependent clause. So I'm wondering if tharumen, the first word in verse 8, is actually it. So we're hanging the participles, and then we're going to get to verse 8. So let me just kind of pause there and see if there are some observations or comments or any questions. Not too hard. Okay, you have to look up the vocab. Okay, well then Paul continues in verse 8. Tharumen de kai eodokumen malon ek de mesai ek tu somatas kai en de mesai prostan kirion. Now we actually do have two indicatives, present indicatives, from tharao, again, to be of good courage. We are brave, we have good courage, and we eodokeo, rather, to be away from the body and to be at home with the Lord. Those are two aorist participles, aorist infinitives active. They follow the pattern of lusai with the circumflex. So, again, from ek demeo and en demeo. Now, the one interesting thing here that occurred to me, I did a little tiny bit of work on this yesterday, is how to translate eodokeo. See? And you can see it's from dokeo, which means to think, or impersonally for something, to seem to be something. And you've got the eu on the front. So it can certainly mean we are well pleased. This is the verb in the baptism and in the transfiguration account. This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. But that, you know, to be honest, that all, I think that's how it's translated here, at least in some of the versions, English translations. It's always been a little jarring. It's almost like against the main contours of his thought, Paul is saying, well, you know, we'd rather actually be dead, which sort of is in some tension, at least, with what he just said. That is, we long for mortality to be swallowed up by life. So I actually looked up a little bit on eodokeo, and it not only can be translated into English to be pleased or well pleased to do something, but it can mean to be willing to or to be ready to. And I wonder if that might be more of the sense here, just a little bit of looking around, and especially Liddell and Scott. But, for instance, we have another use of that in flip over to chapter 12. And, by the way, this does show the value of word studies. Word studies are of secondary value in exegesis, but they certainly are of value. And, you know, they should not be neglected just because they can be abused. Verse 10, Paul is talking about boasting in my weaknesses, verse 9, in order that the power of Christ may tent upon me, episkenao. Verse 10, therefore, I am, here it's translated, I think, I am content. See, I am content with weaknesses, with being treated hubristically, with necessities, persecutions, and so forth. So I think that would probably be, theologically, that sounds like a better way to render it. In other words, to weaken the force a little bit in English of eodokumen back in verse 8. So we are of good courage, and we are content, rather, or we are willing, rather, to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. And, of course, the great conceptual parallel would be Philippians 1. That is, in some sense, it is far better to depart and be with Christ. In some sense. Absolutely right. And you could probably list them. There's no temptation. There's no danger. There, you know, the interim state, as we sometimes call it, must be, we're just guessing here, of course, so I'm already about to say too much about it. Well, it must be a profound experience of rest, because that's one of the words that the Bible uses to talk about what that's like to be dead in the Lord. Right? But again, in our current context, okay, here comes the Gibbs speech number 6. I'm sorry, I won't go off and say that anymore. So, otherwise, it's pretty easy to translate the rest of the verse. Not a hard sentence. Comments on verse 8? Yes, Harry.
I actually had a question about the pros.
Yes?
It's odd that it's almost like directional.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Is that like, you translate that eschatologically then?
To be at home. Well, you could. You know, Wallace actually has a comment here. And it would depend on if I'm right in this regard. It's a good question. En de meo means to presumably be located, to be at home. So it's more of a static verb. Wallace actually has a comment here, and he notes that sometimes you have, well, it goes both ways. You have static, sort of motionless verbs, and prepositions like pros or ace that have a motion involved in them. Or you can have the other way around. You can have en plus the dative or something attached to a verb that implies movement, right? And what Wallace suggests actually is that the verb, whatever the verb is, it's neutralizing the motion in the prepositional phrase. And by the way, we were just talking about this. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was prostantheon. The Word was toward God, see? Normally translated, and some want to make it some kind of a dynamic relational whatever, which has always struck me as leaning a little too hard on a prepositional phrase. And there it's just the linking verb. So it's a good observation. At least that's what Wallace might suggest. And I'm actually inordinately proud of myself that I remembered that, although I cannot give you the page number. So maybe the process normal force is neutralized a little bit just because of the verb. With which it's being used. So, very good. Other comments. So, man, I feel like I should retire after knowing that one. Okay. Let's do 9 and 10. Dia kai phila temumitha. We have all these epsilon contract verbs here. Eta de en de muntes, eta ek de muntes, eoares toi auto enai. Tu scarpanta semas fane rothe de emprasten tu bematas tu Christu. Hina comiseta hecastas, ta dia tu somatas, pras ha eproxen, eta agathan, eta faulon. Therefore, verse 9, also, we make it our goal, we have as our plan or purpose or something like that. From philotimeo. Whether we are being in the body or being out of the body, the two participles there, while we are in the body, while we are at home or away from home. And what's the goal? Ani, to be. Eorestoi. It's an adjective. It means, you could probably guess, it means pleasing. Pleasing ones to him. Now, here's a little bit of a grammatical thingy. With the infinitive, you would normally expect both the subject and the object to be what case? With the infinitive.
Accusative,
right. When the subject of the infinitive and of the linking verb, when the subject of the linking verb infinitive is the same as the nominative case subject of the main verb, so it's we are making it our ambition so that we be pleasing, the nominative actually carries over, which is why you don't have eores tous. Normally with an infinitive, you know, you would express, you know, the object to be accusative. And if the subject were something other than the we, then it would be accusative. So, for instance, if Paul had wanted to say, talking about his work as apostle and pastor, we make it our goal that you be pleasing, then it would be humas and aorestus, then it would be accusative. But just because the nominative we is being carried over from the main verb. And then Paul explains why. Why is that our desire? Why are we philotimeoing that? Answer, because it is necessary. Well, what is necessary? Look for an infinitive, right? The it is almost always an infinitive. Us to be manifested is necessary. And then you just attach everything else to that. So, tus pantas, all us to be manifested is necessary. Oh, to be manifested where? before the Bema of Christ, the judgment seat of Christ, right? So in better English, for it is necessary for all of us to be manifested before Christ's judgment seat for a purpose, in order that each one may komizo in the middle, when you look it up, means receive, okay? In order that each one may receive ta dia tu somatas, the things through the body towards which we acted, or something like that. Here, I wonder if pros plus the accusative is sort of like the adverbial accusative of reference. The lexicon gives this as one of the possible meanings. So translate, with respect to which we acted. And what might that be which we receive? Eta agathon, eta phalon, whether good or foul. Right? And by the way, for Lutherans at least, we find these verses interesting because Paul, not once or twice, but on a number of occasions, talks about judgment being, you always have to be very careful the way you say this, in view of works or according to works or something like that, which, of course, is very similar to the way the Lord Jesus talks. As, for instance, in Matthew 16, he says, the Son of Man is about to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and he will apodidomi me. He will pay to each according to his praxen, according to his work. Right? For my money and Paul, the picture to use at this point is to go running right to 1 Corinthians 3, to a very underused passage, which I think is very helpful. That's the passage where Paul talks about you can't lay any other foundation than the one which is laid, which is Christ. And then every believer is building on the one foundation. And some are building better than others, right? Gold, precious stones, silver, wood, hay, stubble, right? So the judgment is carried out in view of works or in accordance with works. Now, what determines whether or not a person is saved, as Paul says, even through fire, is whether or not you're on the foundation, not the material with which you built. So, I, for instance, I was taught back in the day that there are degrees of glory. Does anybody know this phrase? Were you taught that degrees of, oh, good, it's still being mentioned. You have to be careful with it, but it's a biblical, it's certainly a biblical way of speaking, and I wonder if that's what's going on here. All of us, because Paul's talking to Christians, right? Especially. So everyone's going to be manifested and will receive each one the things through the body in relation to which we acted, whether good or evil. So a guy like Stelzer over there, three rubies in his crown, right? Nava, four, right? Berst, well, he'll be saved yet as through fire, right? Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. But and that's even a better one because it's clear that everybody gets in except the one who didn't want to be a servant at all. Right. So, good. That was a little theology. Sorry, this is supposed to be Greek club. It's supposed to be boring, but I couldn't help myself. So, questions, comments about through verse 10? We got a few, another minute or two. Yeah, and we're coming up to the great, one of the great passages in Paul theologically, so let's just get another verse or two under our belt. So verse 11, Edates un tan phaban tu kyrio anthropus pethamen theode pephanerometha elpizo de kai entais sin edeses in humon pephanerosthai. Therefore, again, the participle of oida, which is, again, it's perfect in form technically, but it's acting like a present stem form. Because we are knowing the fear of the Lord, probably an objective genitive, we are persuading men. By the way, notice that, I mean, in Paul, the judgment day is often motivation for sanctification. The judgment day is often motivation for sanctification, as in the epistle from 2 days ago, right? The night is far gone, the day is at hand, right? Put off the deeds of darkness, put on the armor of light. Paul does this fairly often, where he holds out the judgment day as a reason for us to, again, to use technical terms, be good, right? And to do what we're supposed to do. So he says, if it's causal, because we know the fear of the Lord, we are persuading men, and, but, we have been made manifest in relation to God or to God. And I think that little clause is setting up what he's about to say. So it's like, okay, God knows us, right? We have been perfect passive. We are manifest to God. And I hope, he says, also, now that reconciliation between Paul and the Corinthians has been sort of restarted through Titus, we'll get to him in chapter 7. We left him in chapter 2. And I hope also to be manifested in relation to your consciences, right? Or something like that. This infinitive would probably be indirect discourse. I hope that I, specifically here, I suppose, I am manifested also in relationship or to your consciences, your awarenesses, or something like that. All right?
What does that even mean?
I don't know what it means. That's just what it says, Will. It's about the growing, and I'm very happy to say this, and you're a language guy, the growing rapprochement between Paul and the Corinthian church. I mean, they've been on the odds, and they've been complaining about him because he's not an impressive apostle and all this kind of nonsense, right? And now that, again, literally, Titus, has been the messenger of the, who's kind of worked things back together, and now Paul is, he's kind of appealing to that personal relationship. So I hope that in relation to your awareness, you really know who we are. That kind of a thought, something like that. So, yeah, it's very human. The Corinthian letters are very human. There's a lot of personal relationship there. So, okay? All right. Well, let's stop there, and we'll head off to amazing and stunningly edifying classes.